A new graphic memoir explores a family's troubled past in Nazi Germany.
Memory is such a visual thing, and we use the images in our head to construct narrative in retrospect out of the experiences that we all have. And I think that, to me, therefore, it was the most natural process to combine images and words to tell this story about the memory of war.
That's Nora Krug. We talk with her about her memoir, Belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home. Then, when her daughter got into college in Manhattan, celebrated New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast wanted to give her a guide to getting around in the city.
I said, well, you know, the city is laid out like a grid. It's hard to get lost. And she said, well, what do you mean? So I got a piece of paper and I explained, these are the avenues, these are the streets. So if you're on like 45th Street and you want to walk up to 50th Street, you just walk uptown five blocks. And she actually said to me, what's a block?
We'll talk with Roz Chast about the graphic book that came out of her guide for her daughter. It's called Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Nora Krug grew up in Germany half a century after World War II, but that war cast a long shadow throughout her childhood and youth. For her, just being German bound her to the Holocaust and its atrocities, making it hard to feel that she belonged to her country. Krug knew little about her own family's history during the war. None of her grandparents ever spoke about it. As a young adult, she moved first to the UK, then to the U.S., where she became an American citizen. Then, nearly two decades after leaving Germany, she decided to find out what happened during the war and whether finding out could help her understand what it means to be a German of her generation. Krug returned to her hometown to speak with relatives and to consult archives on a quest to uncover her family's wartime story. The book that resulted, Krug's memoir, Belonging, is a record of one German woman's struggle with the weight of catastrophic history. It's also a reflection on the responsibility that we all have as inheritors of our country's pasts. Nora Krug is a German-American author and illustrator whose drawings and visual narratives have appeared in publications including The New York Times, The Guardian, and elsewhere. She's the author of five books, several of them for children. Krug teaches illustration at the Parsons School of Design. Well, Nora Krug, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
This book, Belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home, this is a graphic memoir. First, just tell us why the graphic format, what about the graphic format enabled you to tell this story, this really very moving story, so well?
Well, I started out as an illustrator, so I'm actually coming to the whole project from a visual point of view, and I never thought about only using words to tell this story. So to me, it was never a question of not using illustrations. But I also think that illustrations, like any other visual medium, allows for a particular, very direct emotional access into subjects of history and politics in a way that are just very different from a more traditional, for example, history textbook. And so I also thought a lot about how memory works and the memory of the war in particular. And memory is such a visual thing. And we use the images in our head to construct narrative in retrospect out of the experiences that we all have. And I think that, to me, therefore, it was the most natural process to combine images and words to tell this story about the memory of war.
Now, you grew up in the 1990s, and your parents were not even born until after the war.
Both my parents were born in 1946, so about a year after the war ended.
And, you know, it made me, I was thinking as I read the memoir, Belonging, of the film The Nasty Girl. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have not yet seen it, but people have mentioned it to me several times, and I really feel like I should put it on the top of my list of films to watch.
Well, it was interesting because it's a movie about a high school girl who begins to discover the story of the Holocaust in Germany, and she's German, and the silence that surrounds her, how difficult it is for her to break that silence. By the time you were a child, that silence had already been broken. What was it like growing up under the burden of Germany's responsibility for the Holocaust?
Well, the war and the Holocaust were always present in my childhood and youth, even though not always in a direct way necessarily. But there was just this knowledge of what our country had done that seeped into my consciousness even before I had learned about it consciously in school. Certain words that I heard spoken for the first time, such as concentration camp, or even before I knew their meaning, I sensed that, you know, something had basically gone horribly wrong in our country. And of course, that made me grow up with a sense of, you know, feeling inhibited, but later on also ashamed, this kind of collective inherited shame that really set in when we started learning about the war and Germany's atrocities in school, which we learned an incredible amount about.
Yeah, I'd like to explore that notion of collective guilt with you, because it doesn't seem fair that generations that were not born even near the time that a crime was committed would come under the notion of collective guilt, something that you actually take on as something for yourself, as opposed to, say, your parents or grandparents. Could you talk more about that process?
I never thought about the question of fairness when I grew up. I just accepted that inherited guilt as part of my life. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily a bad thing, because, I mean, if I learned one thing from writing this book, it's that history is not a thing of the past, that it continues living in us, and that we have to continue to look back at history and face up to it and take responsibility for what happened. So even though these atrocities were committed before even my parents were born, I can't see myself as separate from them. So I don't think that it's necessarily wrong to feel a sense of shame. And I also don't really know where the boundaries are between German shame and human shame, because I would think that anybody who visits a concentration camp museum today feels some sort of, you know, shame about, you know, what it's like to be human, and that these atrocities are possible, that people can, you know, one human being can do something like that to another. So I think if we didn't feel these things, then we also wouldn't learn to take responsibility in our contemporary lives. I mean, if they left us untouched, or if we'd only point the finger elsewhere, we, you know, it would be too easy. But that being said, I do think that there was a paralyzing quality to this shame that was not helpful, because when you feel paralyzed in your shame, you become passive and you don't really understand how to apply what you've learned from history to the present. And I think that's something that our educational system certainly did not do enough of. They did not then teach us what we could do to make our contemporary society more tolerant or empathetic. And so what I've again learned from writing the book is that I'm attempting to move beyond the paralyzing feeling of that shame and think more about what this means individually, you know, what happened in my family. How can I take responsibility for the more personal story and less the bigger picture, the collective shame that all Germans may share?
And, you know, and just one other point before we get into the meat of the book. You ask a question, and it's one I've also asked myself. And I have to say, you know, I think a lot of my listeners know this, that I've explored extensively the history of World War II and the Holocaust. I mean, my father was Dutch, and he was a member of the Dutch underground. But there certainly was in Holland, you know, after the war, this whole notion of were you good or were you bad during the war, because there was a lot of collaboration that went on. But it was during the course of that research that I learned something I hadn't known before, which was that nobody talks about the atrocities that were committed on the German people. The firebombing, for example, of Dresden, or the terrible ethnic cleansing that happened after the war. You asked that question as well. Why wasn't that taught?
I don't really know why it wasn't taught, but my suspicion is that it was just difficult for Germans to even consider their own suffering, at least publicly, because it would have felt wrong. And I myself have, you know, have issues with that. I mean, of course, the firebombing of Dresden was wrong. But to me, the backdrop is always the fact that most Germans supported Hitler as their leader, and that, you know, Germans brought all of that upon themselves. But we didn't learn much about that in school at all. And of course, that's also a question of history writing. Who wrote German history after the war? Who wrote the school books? You know, it's always a question of, yeah, I mean, what do you put in a school book? And W.G. Sebald also wrote about this inability on the German part to consider their own suffering in one of his books. And it's an interesting thing to think about. But on the opposite end, what we also didn't really learn enough about was the German resistance in school. And I wonder if that was partly because had we learned more about that, those people who actually tried to make a difference or try to overthrow Hitler, our own grandparents who didn't resist would have looked guiltier in comparison. So it's interesting in retrospect to think about what we learned about and what we didn't.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nora Krug about her graphic memoir, Belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home. Now, talking about home, you spent some time really exploring the German word Heimat. Tell us about that word. It has a particular resonance, and it's a word that you were not initially comfortable with, but it seems that this book has become a way for you to become more comfortable with it.
Yes, so Heimat basically describes the place that you feel rooted in or most comfortable in or most connected to, or also used to feel most connected to. And for a lot of people, that's the place where they grew up. It's often associated also with particular types of landscapes or food, music, certain local accents. So the foreign book title of Belonging is actually Heimat, because the book is as much a search into my family's history and into who my grandparents were as it is a search of German cultural identity, because our sense of cultural identity is still so deeply tied to the Second World War and the atrocities that Germany committed. So in a way, the book had to be about both my family and my German cultural identity. And to me, coming out of this process of writing and researching and drawing, I still can't say that I really know what Heimat means to me. I think it's a term that's very complex. I personally associate it most with my childhood and things like the walks I took with my family in the nearby wine region and the forests and the foods that we ate. But it also feels like something that that I've lost, or that I only started to recognize once I've lost it, because it's so deeply connected to my childhood. And because I've been living abroad for almost 20 years, I think my sense of this, you know, cultural belonging is very complex anyway. But I also really believe that Heimat should not be something that's static. I think it should be something that evolves through time and through societies, because societies evolve and times change. And I think our notion of who we are should change along with that. And I think it would be wrong to think of it as something that cannot or shouldn't ever change, because that would automatically mean that you exclude certain kinds of people from that space. And that's exactly what the Nazis did. And so I don't think there's a clear, definite answer of what that space should be.
So tell us about your hometown, about your Heimat, your family's town.
Yeah, so the town I grew up in is called Karlsruhe, and it's located in the southwest of Germany, just outside of the French border. very close to the Rhine, and it's a medium-sized town. And when the war was over, the French more or less rode across the Rhine and captured my hometown. And then the Americans, a few months later, the Americans took it from the French. So basically my parents grew up under the American sector.
Tell us about your father. He had quite a difficult childhood, and part of the reason for that was because of the loss of his older brother during the war.
Yes, so his older brother was 17 when he was drafted, and he was drafted, from what I was told, he was drafted into the SS unit. And he fought in Italy and also in other countries, but he didn't return from one particular battle in Italy not that long after he was drafted into the SS and died in Italy at age 18. And of course, the loss that my grandparents felt was immense, and they had another child, my father, after the war. But they named him after the dead brother. And I think that probably wasn't that uncommon at the time, especially in the countryside. They were both farmers, and they had wanted the older son to take over the farm. And now that he was dead, they were assigning that task to their younger son. And they wanted my father to be the heir to the farm and the fields that they owned. And so they named him after the dead brother, which ended up being some kind of a burden for my father, because he was a very different kind of child than his brother. He was in no way a perfect child, and he felt a tremendous sense of pressure and also a sense of growing up in the shadow of his older brother.
And he was really emotionally abandoned.
Yes, his father died when he was 1 year old, and his mother, he was basically completely neglected by his mother and grew up doing whatever he wanted, but he also wasn't provided for by anybody in the family. He often went hungry. The mother made a series of bad decisions in her life, and they became very poor. And so all he wanted later on in his life was to leave the village where he grew up in and go to a bigger town, my hometown, to study so he could become a teacher. And so he completely abandoned the idea of becoming a farmer and taking on his parents' farm.
A very important part of this memoir, Nora Krug, of belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home, is your search for your grandfather's record during the Nazi time. Take us through some of that.
Yes, so my maternal grandfather was a driving teacher during the war in my hometown. And my mother and my aunt had always told me that because he was needed at the so-called home front to teach German soldiers how to drive, that he wasn't sent to the front line. And so that he had always said that he'd never held a gun in his hands. And, you know, that's a truth that's very easy to live with, and a story and that narrative that provided a comfort to my guilt-ridden teenage mind. And so I never questioned it until I started working on the book. And I realized that any narrative that had been told in the family, you just can't rely on. And you have to go back and ask more detailed questions. And of course, one of the places to go to ask questions is the archive. And the local archives carry a tremendous amount of materials about individuals that have only become accessible not that long ago. And so I went to my hometown's archive, and I was looking for a U.S. military file on my grandfather. And there were basically thousands of those kinds of files, because after the war, if you lived in the American sector, every German under the age of 18 had to fill out a questionnaire of, I believe, 313 questions that would provide information about their lives under the Nazi regime. And once you had filled these out, you were ranked into five different categories, ranging from major perpetrator to minor offender to follower and victim under the regime. And based on what you were ranked into, you were given different kinds of sentences. Your account might be barred, you might lose your job, you might be sent to a re-education camp or to prison, or obviously if you were a major perpetrator, you'd be executed. So I went to the archive to ask whether such a file existed on my grandfather, and the archivist immediately confirmed that there was such a file. And I leafed through it, and it was a very emotional moment for me, obviously, because I was holding in my hands the same exact form that my grandfather had held in his hands and filled out almost 70 years before, and that nobody had probably touched since then. And he filled it out with his blue fountain pen and with his typewriter, and the immediacy of reading what he wrote really caused this sense of intimacy between him and I. And I felt as if he was finally answering the questions that I had been burning to ask for so many years. So as I leafed through the file, one of the first questions in the questionnaire was, were you a member of the Nazi party? And he answered yes. And that was a big shock to me and my entire family, because he had always voted for the Social Democrats before the war, which is the Democratic Party of Germany and which was the Nazis' biggest political enemy. So also 15% of all Germans were members of the Nazi party. So, of course, I wondered immediately why he felt that it was necessary to join, or why he was even inclined to join. And then as I leafed my way through this file page by page, he basically, in the letters he wrote to the U.S. military government in Germany, he was trying to make a case for himself and try to explain why it was that he joined the party. And basically those letters bit by bit revealed to me the reasons for why he joined.
And what were your own feelings once you learned everything? How did it change the way you felt about him?
You know, that's one of these questions that's difficult to answer, because I don't think I have any clear conclusions about that. But I think what writing the story and researching my grandfather's life has allowed me was to feel closer to him. Not necessarily in a fully empathetic way, because there were decisions that he made that I think were the wrong decisions, but it allowed me to get closer by asking these questions that I couldn't ask of him directly before, because he was dead by the time I learned about the war and the Holocaust in school, and so I could never confront him directly about that. But I really grew up with him, experiencing him as a very distant figure. And I never really thought about even the fact that he had once been young until I learned about the war in school, because then I tried to picture him as a young man in Germany and wondering, you know, what that meant. And so the act of drawing him and visualizing him in situations that I had no visual proof for, some of these situations being very personal ones, allowed me to test the boundaries of my own empathy towards the decisions he made, but also allowed me to almost physically get closer, because I recreated his life and I made it become visible, and therefore made it come to the surface by drawing it on the piece of paper that was lying right in front of me. And so that created the sense of closeness that I'd never felt towards him before.
And you imagine him witnessing a terrible incident that happened during the Nazi time, I guess 1937, 1938, around Kristallnacht, around the when Jewish businesses and synagogues throughout Germany were destroyed.
Yes, so like in many other German towns, Reichskristallnacht happened in my hometown, and of course my initial thought was he involved in any way? Because you see these terrible photographs when you do image research on that event or on these events that happened all over Germany. You see these terrible photographs of people standing by and watching, and some of them even smiling. I mean, the smiles are really the worst part of it. And of course, not everybody was involved, but I felt like I needed visual proof to see if he was, you know, if he was part of it or not. And of course, you know, I went through hundreds of photographs in my hometown's archive of this event and others, trying to find his face in the crowd so I could get a sense of whether he was there and what these events made him feel like. But of course, I couldn't find him. So I researched everything I could research about the actual event, and in one old phone book from 1938, so the year of Reichskristallnacht, I found in the back of the phone book an old map of the city, and I looked at it, and I looked for the location of his driving school. He owned a driving school at that year. And I saw on the map that his office was located right across from the town synagogue. And so that proximity really made me feel uncomfortable, because it means that there was no way in which he could have avoided seeing or experiencing in some way what was going on. And so in the book, I outline different scenarios, what would have happened if he had been standing in his office looking out the window, or, you know, what if he had been on the road with a driving student and wasn't in his office at that time, or what if he was at home sick. And I try to evaluate how each of these scenarios made me feel and what they would say about his guilt or innocence. And of course, guilt and innocence are utopian terms in a way, because you can't ever fully measure them. So again, there's no clear answer to these questions, but I felt like I needed to ask them in as detailed a way as I possibly could.
And you do an amazing job of doing that. I'd like to ask you really a two-sided question. On the one hand, how has the way Germany chose to do this whole process of kind of penance and redemption and reconciliation around the Holocaust, how did it make Germany a better society, or did it? And then what do you feel about the whole rise of the right in Germany now?
Yeah, so I often think about what Germany would be like now if the war had never happened, because it is now, for the most part, a very liberal country. You know, you see that with Angela Merkel's policies of accepting more immigrants than most other countries in the world in recent years. And I do think that Germany feels a strong responsibility to work on a democratic and open society, and also responsibility to continue to face our history and continue talking about it. But of course, there's also this other side, which is a newly emerging extreme right-wing movement, like in many other countries. But of course, as a German, I'm mostly concerned about the one in Germany. And ironically, though, that movement claims not to be anti-Semitic. I think in Germany, you also, that is something no party could publicly claim, although some of the party leaders have, you know, said things that indicate that they downplay the Holocaust. But sadly, also the extreme right-wing party in Germany has some Jewish members, which is something I only found out recently. And it's just it's a development that's really disturbing, and that I think was underestimated for a long time in Germany, and that we really need to confront. And yeah, I mean, one thing that that the German government now, I think, is doing is rethinking its Holocaust education, and also Holocaust education of newly arrived immigrants. You know, basically stating that everybody who decides to make Germany their home has to receive the same kind of Holocaust education as everybody else who grew up there. And I think that's a very good way of looking at it, is that we have to continue teaching these things and teaching them in the right way, especially now that we're experiencing a generational shift. It's a very sensitive moment, and a moment during which we have to think about how to convey our histories and all these stories that are disappearing now that people are passing away. How can we preserve them? How can we continue to stand up for continuing to shape a democratic society, basically?
Yes, and I think your book, Belonging, Nora Krug, has many lessons for us here in America at this moment, because we have never confronted our history of slavery or the genocide of the Native Americans. And it's something I think we are experiencing the consequences of, what happens when you don't come to terms with your own responsibility.
Yes, I hope that there's a universal quality to the book, which is, as you say, the fact that we are all products of our country's histories, and therefore we have a responsibility, and our histories are not a thing of the past. I mean, slavery is not a thing of the past. If people of color are harassed on the streets or even killed, innocent people, and there's no justice for these crimes, and we have to understand that there's a history to it, that this is a problem that's not new, that's a continuation of what happened in America before. And we need to, now that I'm also an American, I feel a responsibility on that level as well. I think we have a lot of things that we need to work on in our country, America, as well.
Yes. And this book is a real contribution to it. And I want to thank you, Nora Krug, so much for talking with us here about Belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nora Krug. Go to writersvoice.net to see excerpts from her book, Belonging, as well as more of her work. Next up, a love letter to New York by cartoonist Roz Chast. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast is famous for her hilarious depictions of people doing the typical but endearing neurotic things that people do. Her last book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, was a best-selling look at growing up with her parents in Brooklyn. Then, when she had kids, she moved to the suburbs. But can a New Yorker ever really leave New York behind? When her daughter moved to New York for college, Roz Chast decided to create a kind of guide for her. This turned into her new book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. Told through Chast's zany, laugh-out-loud, and pointedly true cartoons, Going Into Town is part New York stories, part personal and practical guide to walking, talking, renting, and venting, an irresistible, one-of-a-kind love letter to the city. Roz Chast, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I just totally love this book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. As a native New Yorker, I laughed out loud with recognition at so many places. You say right up from the start that this is not a guidebook, it's not a history book. Who's this book for, and how did it come about?
It came about because, you know, I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I took sort of knowing the city, I think, a lot for granted, and lived there after college for about 10 years. And when we had kids, we moved out of the city, and, you know, mostly for money reasons, couldn't afford to stay there with two kids. We moved out to suburban Connecticut, and that's where we brought up our kids. And when my daughter was going to college, she decided to go to school in New York. And I thought before she left for school, I should just, I brought her into the city with me many, many, many times, but I thought I should check up to just see what her sense of, you know, how much she had absorbed about how the city was laid out. And I said, well, you know, the city is laid out like a grid. It's hard to get lost. And she said, well, what do you mean? So I got a piece of paper and I explained, these are the avenues, these are the streets. So if you're on like 45th Street and you want to walk up to 50th Street, you just walk uptown five blocks. And she actually said to me, what's a block? And that was kind of a little bit of a learning moment for me, that somebody could actually not know what a block was. But, you know, it makes sense because we don't exactly have, we have some sidewalks in town, but we don't have any sidewalks on our street. And you don't say blocks the same way you do when you live in the city. So before she left for school, I made her this little, like, 16-page booklet that she could carry around in her back pocket that just sort of explained things, just very basic stuff, like Fifth Avenue divides the east side from the west side, because her school was in Manhattan. It was actually School of Visual Arts, so it was, you know, around like 23rd Street, Midtown-ish. And this book, that was the sort of genesis for the little seed around which this Going Into Town formed, was a little booklet that I had made for her. That was, it's a really basic sort of I hope that the book has like just sort of some the most important information you would need to just kind of get around the city. Because I know that a lot of guides will tell you stuff about the Statue of Liberty, but not mention, you know, oh, by the way, Fifth Avenue divides the East Side from the West Side. You know, just really basic stuff.
Which is why so often you see tourists kind of milling around in the middle of the street trying to figure out where they're going.
I know, and then you want to just, like, knock them over. It's just like you're just standing there. You're in my way. Like, don't you understand? It's like, get out of my way. I've got places to go. I've got an engagement with a cup of coffee at the Starbucks across the street. You're in my way.
Yeah. Now, actually, you grew up in Brooklyn, isn't that right?
Yes, that's right.
And yet this is really about Manhattan, not Brooklyn.
Yes.
Not the outer boroughs.
No, it's definitely about Manhattan because that's where, you know, she went to school. And I think of that as, you know, the first place in my life where I was happy in a way, you know. So in a way that Manhattan is as much my home as Brooklyn.
Now, yeah, as you say, you pretty much start right up there with the grid. And I have to say that is the grid is something I love with a passion.
Me too. Me too. Do you have a terrible sense of direction?
Exactly. And
Yes. Like
when I go to Boston, I lived in Western Massachusetts for many years. And when I went to Boston, 100% of the time I got lost because it's just built on cow paths.
I know. I just can't stand it. I cannot stand it. I have such a terrible sense of direction that really the grid keeps me from just kind of like suddenly wandering, like, why am I in Schenectady?
Exactly. Yeah, so now New Yorkers, it's interesting you also talk about the fact that New Yorkers, you know, it's a disadvantage to have a car in New York. And you talk about getting around. Did you know that New Yorkers are on average thinner than other Americans because they have to walk everywhere?
I'm not entirely surprised. When I'm in the city, I walk all the time. And even if I take the subway, I'm walking. You know, you're going up and down stairs and, you know, you're walking from one end of the station to the other. And if you're changing trains and et cetera, you know, you're always moving. You're always on the go.
Yeah, so talk about the subway. You have a section on it, and I love it. And, of course, everybody understands so much of what, you know, everything that you have in this book is, this is a graphic guide to New York City, this love letter to New York, Roz Chass. So they're just marvelous pictures of the people that you can see on the subway, and you can spend a lot of your time just watching people. But how do you watch people in New York?
How do you not watch people when you're in New York? It's just an amazing, amazing place and unique among cities, I think partly because of the geography. It's extremely dense because, you know, Manhattan, of course, is an island. And, you know, there are many other great cities, but a lot of them, you know, there'll be like a crowded area where there, you know, a populated area, and then huge stretches where there's just like nothing. And then maybe like another pocket of people, and then huge stretches. You know, I'm thinking of like places like Chicago or something. But in Manhattan, you know, even like 11th Avenue or like 12th Avenue or some insane place like that, there are still always people on the street.
Yeah, and I was actually angling for you to talk about, there's a certain kind of glance you have to employ. And I remember learning this. I grew up actually for a certain period of time in northern New Jersey, but I went into the city every single weekend. And I would always take the bus from my flute lesson up on the Upper East Side down to Washington Square Park. I'd take the Fifth Avenue bus. So I learned very early at the age of 12 how to perform the New York watchful glance.
Yes, the kind of looking around, because I don't know how old you are, but in my day when I was growing up, there was such fear of somehow meeting the eyes of a crazy person, at least in my parents' minds, that, you know, they taught me very early, you don't look directly at a person because they could be a crazy person. So you look, but you don't look directly. And it's also, I think, kind of rude. To stare at people. I think New Yorkers have a different sense of, maybe because we're all so packed in closely together, I was trying to explain this to my husband the other day, that like if you're in the elevator, you don't make chit-chat with the people in my building. I might, like, you know, nod hello or, you know, say, you know, have a good evening or whatever, but, like, because it's so crowded, I like being given my space, and I like being able to give people my space, not in an unfriendly way, just, you know, I don't feel the need to always engage with people. But I imagine that if you lived in some, like, small town where the next town is, you know, 20 miles away, maybe seeing another person, you just want to have, like, a whole lifetime conversation. But it's different. It's a different feeling in the city, I think.
Right. I lived in rural West Virginia for a while, and anywhere you were, you raise your hand and greeted the person you saw.
Right.
Even passing in a car, people would wave to you, wave to them. Now, you'd never do that in New York, but on the other hand, I do find that I think New Yorkers are much, much nicer than their reputation.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm much less judgmental and more open. But, you know, there is a kind of New York provincialism, I think, you know, that kind of feeling that, like, we're definitely the center of the world. I mean, there's no question about that. But, you know, which is a kind of very provincial attitude in a way, because, I mean, it's ridiculous. There's so many cities in China that also had, like, 8 million people that, like, you know, who are we to think anything?
Well, it's like that famous cartoon by Jules Pfeiffer, where you see New York in the, you know, the foreground, and then there's kind of New Jersey.
Saul Steinberg, right, yeah.
Oh, Saul Steinberg, okay,
right.
Not Jules Pfeiffer.
Right.
You're right. Yeah, and then the rest of the country is just kind of on the
lips.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, like Los Angeles is somewhere out there, San Francisco, Chicago somewhere in the middle. But, you know, it's a little bit blurry.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. And the other thing, now, back to the subway, I don't remember if you talk about this. I think you do. You know, anybody will give you directions. I mean, sometimes I get confused in the subway. I'm not sure if I've gotten on the uptown or the downtown. And I'll come in and I'll just say, does this stop at? And everybody will tell me exactly.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's, you know, people will have opinions about it. It's like, no, no, no. You need to change for the C. It's like, no, no, no. The C doesn't run. Then, you know, I mean, I've witnessed that sort of interaction. I think people are friendly, but there's also that sense that you don't have to make chit-chat. I mean, when I've traveled and somebody starts talking to me in the elevator, it always takes me aback a little bit. It's like, do I know you? What? You know what, you're talking to me? Why?
We are speaking with Roz Chass, the great cartoonist for The New Yorker, about her new book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. So now the subways have been much in the news lately because things have gotten much worse, I'm sure, than they... Well, I know since I was a kid going into the city, and probably you as well. Talk about the rise, fall, and rise and fall of its fortunes that you've witnessed over your life.
Oh, brother. Well, I think that they're better than when I was growing up. I mean, in the 70s, it was pretty bad. I mean, just as far as crime went. And the ridership was down, too. And that, you know, just became a sort of vicious circle that, you know, the fewer people rode them, the more people that got afraid, the more crime there was. And I liked the nice graffiti, but I also very clearly remember going into cars where the inside was completely scrawled over with graffiti that was very ugly, you know, and sort of assaultive. So that doesn't exist anymore. And they're definitely, you know, the ridership is up. It's crowded, which I think is actually a good thing. But the bad thing is that the system itself is very old. It was old when I was growing up. You know, some of the subway is, I don't know, like 100 years old. I mean, some of the tunnels, it's
more
really... It's a little alarming. I mean, sometimes, you know, you're standing on the platform and you see this kind of decrepitude, you know, just stuff falling apart. you know, that's like held in place by like wires. And it's just like, oh my God, this is actually a little bit alarming, but hopefully it won't fall apart and collapse while I'm in the train. But, you know, they're trying to fix all of it. It's just that it all takes money, and, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I think some of that switching technology dates from the 1930s.
Yes. Yeah, there's parts of the subway. It's like patched together from like, this is from the 30s, this is from the 20s, this is from the 50s, this is from, you know, 2000. It's a kind of amazing system that it works as well as it does. Mm-hmm. And it's the most extensive subway system, I think, in the country, you know, the largest, and also the fact that it runs 24 hours, which I don't know if that's going to continue. I heard some story that they're going to have to shut it down for a few hours during the night to just do some of these really long-needed repairs. But the fact that it works at all is incredible, and we complain about it because I think, you know, we all like to complain, but it's so much better than so many other systems. And also, you know, you really don't need a car. Mm-hmm. And that is, for me, you know, the greatest thing of all, because I hate cars and I hate driving, and I just, it's wonderful not to have to think about that.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about some of the, of course, treasures, not in a sense of, you know, like the Statue of Liberty, which, like you, I, as a New Yorker, I've never been to the Statue of Liberty.
guilt.
But the museums, of course, and especially the Met and the Museum of Natural History, just the most magnificent collections. You would go there a lot as a child, is that right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when I was a kid, we used to go to the Brooklyn Museum. That was the museum of my childhood.
Yeah. Also wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember the New Guinea section with the masks, and, you know, they were sort of terrifying. They were like the worst horror movie you could imagine. They scared me when I was a kid. But I also wanted to look, you know, because mm-hmm. they were sort of fascinating.
Now, I have to ask you a question. You mentioned the Museum of Natural History, and you say that your favorite object there is the Agnigito meteor.
Yeah, the meteor.
So it's so heavy that its supports go all the way down to the bedrock of Manhattan.
Yeah.
So how did they ever move it into the museum, or did it just kind of crash through the roof and stay there?
I don't know. I know that it's so heavy that it had to be supported by these things that go into the bedrock of Manhattan, but how they got it there, I actually don't know.
Mm-hmm. You have a wonderful page here on ancient New York.
Oh,
this is one of my laugh out loud moments. You know, the scaffold on West 81st Street that's believed to have originated in the early 12th century AD.
Yeah, those scaffolds. I mean, some of them, they're just up for, it just seems like, decades.
Oh, yeah, they are. In fact, the one right in front of the built, my mother was a downtown artist. She was a dancer in Soho, and she bought her place, a loft on Broadway in 1974 for, you know, like the unheard of price of like $12,000 or something.
Wow, wow.
And it's still there, and there's a dance studio there, and, you know, people live there. But at a certain point, it's a cast iron building, and some of the cast iron pieces were falling down, so we had to put up a scaffold. And that scaffold must have stayed up for about 10 years while we were getting the permits to do that.
Oh, God. Yeah, anything involving building in New York, I'm glad that is not my business. It just seems impossible.
So I love that you notice that, you know, the things just come and, you know, the New York has its own ruins, in other words.
Yes. Oh, definitely. I mean, the subway, in some ways, is a little bit of a ruin. I mean, right. You know, you see those tiles from a very long time ago, you know, the wonderful typography, and I don't know, but I guess that's partly what I like about it, it's we may not have like a 16th century, you know, castle in our midst. It's not like London, the history of London or Rome or anything. When you go to these cities, and it's like, oh, this is history. This, you know, not ours. We don't really have history like that. But maybe actually down way downtown, you know, there's more. But the past in New York is always visible, you know, whether it's the trolley tracks that are, you know, coming up through the street, or, you know, they tear down a building and then you see, you know, the image of an old ad for like Murray suits, you know, from the 1920s that like was there in the 20s, and then a building went up, and then that building, you know, and then it blocked it, and then that building came down, but the ad for, you see the image of, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly. There's
those ads.
Layers and layers of history.
Yeah, yeah, and I like that.
Yeah, but in other ways, you know, gentrification has vastly transformed the city. There's a website and a book called Vanishing New York.
Yes,
in fact,
I've seen it.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think we're in danger of losing our beloved New York City?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I do feel that New York is always changing, and I don't like nostalgia as a rule. I just feel like it's a kind of there's something sort of rotten about it. And, yeah, gentrification has definitely, you know, it's definitely there. But on the other hand, why have nostalgia for something that was dirty and disgusting? I mean, when people talk about old New York, you know, oh, in the 70s, you know, when it was like, you know, CBGBs and this and that, they're also like missing the part where I still remember there was a nice, like, little new boutique on my corner, and the woman who worked there, you know, a guy came in with a gun and shot her and robbed the store. I knew so many people who were mugged or held up at gunpoint or at knife point. You know, just living with that is really hard to convey what that was like, and that was not a good way to live. And you can't have both, you know?
Well, I guess I'll push back a little bit on that, because maybe crime and gentrification is, I remember, for example, before the big box stores were allowed into New York.
Yeah.
And how many more mom and pop stores there were. Or, for example, the fact my mother would have never been able to, as a dancer, a modern dancer who made no money at all, she would have never been able to afford that space.
I know. I mean, that is definitely a sad thing. Because, you know, when I started, everybody I knew lived in Manhattan. And we all lived sort of a $5 cab ride away from each other. Because you could, my first apartment was $250, and it did not have a stove, but who cared, you know? And it was possible to live in New York as a middle class person, you know, as a working class person. And that's kind of, that needs to be protected, I think. It can't just only be for rich people. And that, you know, that's horrible. So, yeah, I guess deep down it makes me very sad to see that happen. But also, I live on the Upper West Side, and I'm amazed at how much of the past is still there.
Yes.
So, like, 72nd Street, it's not, I don't know why the Upper West Side is like that, but it's still, to me, there's still a lot there that I remember from when I was living there in the 80s. But, you know, yeah, it's changed. There's big box stores and the movie theaters are going. But that is part of a much bigger picture. It's not just the gentrification of New York. Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, the way we shop has changed because of, you know, the internet. And that impacts everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, mom and pop stores, it's not, I mean, even Barnes and Noble, you know, they have a hard time existing in this climate, because people don't shop the same way, you know?
That's true. Although I have heard just the other day that ebooks are not doing that well, and that not maybe not in New York, but where the rents are so high, but other places in the country, bookstores are coming back. And I want to say this book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, goes a long way to remind us what we still have in the city. Thank you so much, Roz Chast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Roz Chast. Go to writersvoice.net to see cartoons excerpted from Going Into Town. International Women's Day is celebrated this week. In honor of that, I'd like to read a poem from the anthology Poems from the Women's Movement, edited by Honor Moore. This poem is by Susan Griffin. It's entitled, I Like to Think of Harriet Tubman. I like to think of Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman, who carried a revolver, who had a scar on her head from a rock thrown by a slave master because she talked back, and who had a ransom on her head of thousands of dollars, and who was never caught, and who had no use for the law when the law was wrong, who defied the law. I like to think of her. I like to think of her especially when I think of the problem of feeding children. The legal answer to the problem of feeding children is 10 free lunches every month, being equal, in the child's real life, to eating lunch every other day, Monday but not Tuesday. I like to think of the president eating lunch Monday but not Tuesday. And when I think of the president and the law and the problem of feeding children, I like to think of Harriet Tubman and her revolver. And then sometimes I think of the president and other men, men who practice the law, who revere the law, who make the law, who enforce the law, who live behind and operate through and feed themselves at the expense of starving children because of the law. Men who sit in paneled offices and think about vacations and tell women whose care it is to feed children not to be hysterical, not to be hysterical as in the word hysterikos, the Greek for womb suffering, not to suffer in their wombs, not to care, not to bother the men because they want to think of other things and do not want to take the women seriously. I want them to take women seriously. I want them to think about Harriet Tubman and remember she was beat by a white man, and she lived to redress her grievances, and she lived in swamps and wore the clothes of a man bringing hundreds of fugitives from slavery, and was never caught, and led an army, and won a battle, and defied the laws because the laws were wrong. I want men to take us seriously. I'm tired of wanting them to think about right and wrong. I want them to fear. I want them to feel fear now as I have felt suffering in the womb. And I want them to know that there's always a time. There's always a time to make right what is wrong. There's always a time for retribution. And that time is beginning. That was Susan Griffin's poem, I Like to Think of Harriet Tubman. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.